The series that we're doing together this weekend is entitled, the series title is, Preach the Bloody Gospel or Bible. And as I said last night, but I want to repeat because we have people that weren't there last night, why would we choose this series to look at? And there's good reason. That these are the kinds of questions that people who are unbelievers or people who are skeptics, which is stronger than just unbelievers, or those who are agnostics or atheists have. They question the Bible because it seems to have stories that are inconsistent with the God that we claim to follow. We talk about and sing songs, God is love. And then they look at passages like the one we're going to look at this morning and say, how can that be reconciled? These actions, the things that are going on, and the other lessons that we're going to look at are in a similar vein. They're the thorny, sticky questions that we have. And in a lot of cases, I will say, in the past, I think what I've done with some of these is just kind of observe the Passover. You know, just try to get through it quickly and don't talk about it much and hope nobody says, hey, wait a minute. That sounded really harsh. Or I gave a cursory explanation, maybe something as simple as, well, God always does what's right, so even though I don't understand it, that's what he did, and I'm going to accept that. And that's okay, but that certainly doesn't answer the objections of other people. It doesn't help if we're trying to convince the skeptic or convert the agnostic or the atheist. So you can go on the internet and you'll find all kinds of websites now that are antagonistic to the Bible that cite these very things we're looking at this weekend as reasons not to believe it. So I felt I'll accept the challenge. I'll preach the bloody Bible. I'll preach the bloody aspects of the gospel. And when I say the bloody aspects, I'm not necessarily talking about the cross of Christ and the blood he shed. I'm saying it's still good news, even with these difficult stories that we have. So we're going to look at them. And as I told you last night, I think in some cases, and I appreciate very much your reaction to the lesson last night, it's not uncommon, by the way, when I preach on these things, that people feel, oh, wow, they feel relieved. Finally, I'm hearing some answers to some of these things I've just really been puzzled about. And in some cases, I think your reaction is like mine was. I had not read carefully, and now I'm reading carefully, and I'm going, oh, now it makes more sense, and I think I understand a little better. So the deeper we read, the easier it gets for us, I think, and the more assured we are that this Bible is the Word of God. And it's given to us so that we will know God and know Christ and come to a saving faith in him. And that's what we're going to do again today. So let me begin the lesson this morning with a poem. This comes from the Old Testament Made Easy by Jeannie Steig. Cursed Sodom, God raged, is an outpost of hell. I consign it to flames and Gomorrah as well. Two angels dispatched for the purpose told Lot, clear out of here fast before things get too hot. The cesspool called Sodom is doomed. You're excused. Just don't ever look back. God would not be amused. In a shower of brimstone and fire, Lot fled. But his wife absent-mindedly swiveled her head. She was changed to a pillar of salt, Mrs. Lot. I, for one, don't believe she deserved what she got. Now, that's from a person who has a different view of the Bible than I do. But I think it really explains where people are on the story of Lot's wife. So I want to look at it with you this morning. I want to look at it again with you this morning. I know you know the story. It's really interesting to me that Lot's wife, first of all, doesn't have a name. We only know her as Mrs. Lot, and that's only the way we refer to her. The Bible just calls her Lot's wife. She's only mentioned four times, three times in one very concise text in Genesis chapter 19. But where I want to begin is with Jesus' statement about her. Jesus spoke about Lot's wife. In Luke chapter 17, verse 32. Luke chapter 17, verse 32. You know, if you ever get in a contest with people who say, hey, let's see who can recite the most memorized passages, the ones you want to remember is Jesus wept and remember Lot's wife. Because it's that simple. I mean, it's just that one verse. Verse 32, three words. Remember Lot's wife. Now, what's really interesting about that is Jesus is giving a discourse about the last days of the Israelite nation. And in the days of Noah, he talks about people were eating and drinking and marrying. And the same thing happened in the days of Lot. The point that he's making is this is going to come upon God's people suddenly, and it's going to be a complete destruction, and only a few get away. So be one of the people that gets away. But in that context, he just simply throws in three words. Remember Lot's wife. And what's interesting about that to me is I have no doubt everybody who heard him say that immediately remembered the story. I don't think there was anybody there unless it was maybe a small child who had never been in a Bible class who said to his mom or his dad or her mom or dad, "Who's Lot's wife?" But the fact that Jesus just throws that out that way makes us understand she was remembered. And he didn't have to go into detail. You remember who Lot's wife is? We're so familiar with that little story. It has such an impact on us that, I mean, we even tell jokes like the church that where the preacher got tired of everybody turning around and looking at the clock as he got close to the end of his sermon. People would visibly turn and look back at the clock like, "Do you know what time it is?" So he simply put the words underneath the clock, "Remember Lot's wife." And everybody immediately caught the context. You better be careful about doing that. It has consequences. It's looking back. Jesus remembered Lot's wife, even though she's only found three times by that name, Lot's wife, in all the Bible. It's just three simple references. It was such an impact that all of Israel remembered that. Her story is such that Jesus knew people would recall her immediately. Remember Lot's wife. Why would Jesus say that? Because they might be inclined to not remember. I think we're the same way. So I think sometimes we need reminders. Peter said, "I stir your remembrance of things." Don't ever feel slighted or cheated or irritated when preachers or teachers or parents or mentors tell us things that we've already known. Because God constantly reminded Israel in Deuteronomy 6, Judges 3, Psalm 9, Psalm 106, repeatedly. I'm going to go back to those because I want to show you. It's easy to forget even the most important things. In Deuteronomy chapter 6, and verse 12, God says, "Then watch yourself that you do not forget the Lord who brought you from the land of Egypt out of the house of slavery." He's saying, when I bring you into the land and I give you all the houses and the lands and all the things that are there, don't forget the Lord. Don't forget the Lord. And it seems like, how could they forget him? Every time they look around, they see the things he gave them. They're looking at the houses he gave them. They're looking at the cattle he gave them. Yet he says, don't forget. Why? Because he knows our nature. He knows the way we are. That if we don't continually think about him and who he is, we're going to forget the Lord. And the same thing is true in Judges chapter 3. Children of Israel now have crossed over. Joshua's cleaned out the land. We're going to talk about that this afternoon in our lesson, if the Lord allows us to be together. But in Judges chapter 3 and verse 7, it says, the sons of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord and forgot the Lord their God and served the Baals and the Asheroth. And then you've got two statements, one in Psalm 9 and verse 17 and another in Psalm 106, 13 and 21. Psalm 106, 13 and 21. I'm not going to read those, but they're the same thing. They're injunctions that say, be careful that you don't forget God. We need to remember God. And the way we do that is by repeatedly talking about who he is, what he's done, what our obligations are to him. Remember Lot's wife. So let's go back to the story. It's in Genesis chapter 19. Genesis chapter 19. It's a story that we could do two different lessons on, and I'm not going to try to combine them for you today. But we could talk about just the destruction of the cities themselves, Sodom and Gomorrah. We could also talk in detail about Lot himself. Lot's a fascinating character with multifaceted character traits. He's not all good and all bad, but he sure finds himself in a difficult situation. But I want to concentrate our lesson here on this other aspect, Lot's wife herself. So, I'm going to scan the story with you. I'm not going to read all the verses. It begins in chapter 19. Well, actually, the story begins in chapter 18, where God goes to Abraham and he says, hey, I need to tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going down there. I'm going to see what Sodom and Gomorrah are doing because the outcry of what they're doing has come up to me. I just want to verify and make sure that that's the case. And I'm going to destroy the city. I'm going to wipe it out. But Abram bargains with God. He says, man, will you really? I mean, you're going to kill everybody in a city? What if there are 50 righteous people in that city? 50. Will you destroy it, the whole city, if there are 50 people righteous? And God says to him, no, I'll spare it if there are 50. And Abraham says, okay, let me ask you another question. What if there aren't 50, but what if there are 40? Will you destroy it for 40? And God says, no, I won't destroy it for 40. What about 30? What if there are 30? No, I won't destroy it for 30. Be patient with me. What if there's 20? Only 20, but 20 righteous people in the city. Would you destroy it for 20? God says, no. No, I'll spare it if there are 20 people there. And then he says, 10. Okay, what about 10? Now, I want you to think about this. Seems to me there are only two conclusions to draw at this point. God says, okay, I'll spare it for 10, and then the negotiations cut off. One of two things either happened. Either Abraham thought there are 10 people there, the city's going to be spared. I mean, there got to be 10 people there. He knows at least 4 already. Lot, his wife, his two daughters, and he would probably assume their husbands are also there. Surely Lot has influenced them enough. That's 6. We only need to find 4 more people, and we got Sodom and Gomorrah spared. So it could be that Abraham called off the negotiation rather than saying, well, let me ask one, what if there's five? What if there's five? I mean, he's on a tear. You know, God's reducing the numbers pretty quickly. Why didn't Abraham go to five? Well, either Abraham thought there were 10, or God finally said, I'm done negotiating. Not going below 10. And God said, after 10, I'm done. I want you to think about that city. I don't know the size of Sodom and Gomorrah, but the fact that Abraham starts with 50 tells me it must have been a city of at least some size. He's not negotiating for half the population of Sodom here. He's knowing that there's a minority of people, but still there's at least 50, he thinks, who might be righteous there. It's a city of some note. And though the angels that are sent to the city arrive, now we're in chapter 19. They arrive at the gate, and Lot is sitting in the gate of Sodom. That's really interesting. The writer of Genesis is always careful with his wording. And if you read quickly through that, you'll miss clues that are given to us. You see, when Lot first chose to go to Sodom, when Abraham said to him, we can't coexist, our herds are getting too big, they're infringing on each other, I'm finding some of your sheep among mine and some of your cattle among mine and your shepherds and your keepers of the flocks and the goats and the cattle are arguing with us about where to put them all. Look, do this, Lot. You choose one direction and you go that way and I'll go the other direction. We'll just split up. It says, Lot looked and saw Sodom and that the plains were well watered there. And then the writer, again, very carefully, says, Lot chose for himself. There are a couple of things about that. First of all, Lot should have never made the decision. Lot should have never been the one to choose. He's riding on Abraham's coattails. It's Abraham who left Ur of the Chaldees at God's order. Lot's just along for the ride. He's the guest. He's being blessed because Abram is being blessed. This isn't about Lot. This is about Abram. Plus, Abram is his older relative. It's his uncle. And so Lot should have deferred to him on that basis alone. He should have said, no, you choose. I'll go whichever direction you don't go. But he doesn't. And the wording indicates that. Lot chose for himself. He's not saying, you know, sometimes we make decisions that we don't want, but we make the decision because it's the right thing to do. It's like the two boys, you know, that came in to one boy's home and they said, I'm hungry. You got anything to eat? And the other one said, well, let's look in the refrigerator. And he said, there were two pieces of pie. One of them was really big and one of them was fairly small. And he took out the two pieces of pie and his guest said, I'll take the bigger one. And he goes, whoa, wait a minute. He says, That's not right. And he says, well, what would you do? He said, well, if I were to choose, I would do the polite thing and choose a smaller piece. He goes, well, then I'd still gotten the bigger one. Yeah, you know, you think about that. But the point is, it's kind of a protocol. A protocol. You know, you say, oh, no, give me the smaller piece. No, you take the bigger piece. Well, okay. But there's a way of doing that. And Lot isn't doing that. He chose for himself. And then the text tells us that Lot pitched his tent toward Sodom. Now what that means is he's living outside the city. it says the men of Sodom were exceedingly wicked. And this was before the days when God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah. But they've already got a reputation. It's a bad place to be. It's the tombstone territory of Canaan. Bad things happen in Sodom. So naturally, Lot says, I'm not exposing my children, my daughters to that. We'll stay outside. And he'll commute. You know, they got a chariot service that goes back and forth. And he'll just ride into town when they need something from Walmart. He's not going to be across the street. He's going to just go get things and go back to his tent. So he can have the blessings of a big city, but not be in it. And then when Abram has to fight the five kings because they've invaded the land and they went to Sodom and they sacked the city and took captives, it says, and they took Lot, for he was living in Sodom. So what's he done? He's moved. You know, it's a little compromise. It's a little compromise. And it doesn't seem like it's a big deal. But I can understand how that would have happened. His wife says, every time I need something from the store, I got to go all the way. And now the roads are getting crowded. And you get to that one intersection, you can't get through it. Chariots backed up everywhere. And camels all over the place. And can't we... The girls need something better. They've got that community center where they can take classes. Let's move to Sodom. And the price is right now. Housing's really cheap there. I mean, I'm using the kind of argument, these are what we'd say, wouldn't we? This is what we would do. So let's move inside the city. And so now he's living there. And Peter tells us that his heart was stirred every day by the wickedness of the city. He's miserable there. But he's not so miserable that he moves. He stays there. And he does one more thing. By the time we get to chapter 19, I told you, listen to the wording. It's very important. When the angels come in, where is Lot? It says he is sitting in the gates. Now, you need to understand, he doesn't have a job as a night watchman. That phrase is a very pointed phrase in the Old Testament of magistrates. He has become a leading political figure in this city. Chose for himself, living in the tent. Let's move to the city. And next thing you know, vote for me. I'm Lot. Vote for me. And he's become a leading figure in the city. So he's sitting in the gates. That's where the elders sit. And the angels come. And he begins talking to them. Where are you from? Well, distant places. I mean, really distant. What you here for? We're just passing through, kind of getting the lay of the land. Well, he says, come stay with me. Spend the night, wash your feet, rise early and go on your way. And here's what they say. No, we'll just stay in the square. Why do you think verse 3 reads the way it does? He urged them strongly. Why? Well, you may say, well, he's just lonely and wants company, but I don't think that's it at all. I think it's, no, you don't want to stay in the square. And you don't want to be out in the square. It's not a good place to be in this city at night. So they go, and they're in the house, and then you know the story. The men of the city come with their homosexual lusts, and they say to him, bring those men out. We want relations with them. The King James Version said that we may know them, but it wasn't, hey, we're going to get acquainted. It wasn't that no. It was more the no, about like Mary did, had known no man. They want, forgive the language, but it's the only way to really say it. They are going to rape these men. That's what they're there for. It's horrible. It's unbelievable. They don't even know who they are. This is not being done as an act of violence because they hate these men. This is just wanton lust. So Lot makes attempts to assuage them. Don't do this, brothers. And offers his daughters to them. There's a whole story about that that we could talk about. But they say, no, you bring them out. And I want you to look at verse 9. They said, you stand aside. And furthermore, they said, this one came in as an alien and he is acting like a judge. I think that is an allusion to where he is politically. He's a broker in the town and they're saying, you're an outsider. You're not even one of us. Get out of the way or we will treat you worse than them. So they pressed hard and they came near to break the door. I mean, this is a terrifying scene. Lot and his family are holed up inside. These two beings, I don't think, are scared at all. They're just waiting. They might have opened the door and said, you don't want a piece of us. You do not want to take us on. This is not where you want to be. But Lot is locked the door and they're trying to get in the house. And then these two beings say, kind of stand back. And verse 11, they struck the men at the doorway of the house with blindness. Just everybody out there is blind. Suddenly, and what the text tells us about the horrible wickedness of these men, it says they wearied themselves trying to find the doorway. I mean, I want you to think about this. These men are out here and they have a lust boiling inside them, and suddenly, for no reason at all, every one of them is struck blind. And you know they're communicating. I can't see. Neither can I. I mean, I can't see anything. I can't see at all. It's not the lights have gone out in the town. The lights have gone out in their heads. But even then, they're not saying, let's get out of here. Go home. See if this will get better. They are still trying to feel for the door to get inside. It's horrible. These men of Sodom. And then the two men say in verse 12, who have you got in this town? Son-in-law, sons, your daughters, whomever you have in the city, bring them out of the place. For we are about to destroy this place. Because their outcry has become so great before the Lord that the Lord has sent us to destroy it. So Lot goes out. Blind guys all around. He goes out, threads his way through them, spoke to his sons-in-law who were to marry his daughters. They're betrothed or engaged. They're supposed to marry his girls. And he said, up, get out of this place. The Lord will destroy the city. But he appeared to his sons-in-law to be jesting. I said, God, that joke won't work. And so they ignore him. Now, when morning dawned, verse 15, the angels urged Lot. I want you to note the kind of terminology that's being used here. Just in the same way Lot urged them to come into his house for safety, they urge him, it's the reverse, urge him to leave the house for safety. It's the well-written story that gives us this balance in this. They urge him, saying, up, take your wife, take your two daughters who are here, or you will be swept away in the punishment of the city. Verse 16 first three words tells you everything about this story. But he hesitated. Be Lot for a minute. Be Lot. Last night, the men of your city came to take forcibly guests under your protection that they might use them for their sexual desires. And it got so volatile that they threatened you with the same thing and worse if you didn't give up those men. They beat on your door, terrified your wife and your daughters. They threatened your very life. And then these two majestic beings, clearly from God because they have powers nobody else has, blinded all those guys and said, "You get out of the city. We are going to destroy it. Go get anybody in your family or anybody you care about." And it says something that Lot went to his sons-in-law that he thought they would join them. And now today, this is the next morning. If I were Lot, first of all, I didn't get sleep at all. I mean, my sleep number bed did me no good last night. None whatsoever. I didn't sleep. It was a horrible night. And now these two angels are telling me, get out of the city right now. We're going to destroy it. Take your wife, take your daughters, flee. Flee. And Lot hesitated. Why? I've been telling you why. He's become part of this culture. His life is here. His memories are here. His daughters have grown up here. They have found romance with two of the young men from this city. Now, I'm telling you that because this has an impact on the story. He hesitated. It tells you something about how quickly and easily sin can ingrain itself in our lives. It's little by little. And this is what has happened to righteous Lot. Peter calls him righteous Lot. But he hesitated. So what did these men do? They seized his hand and the hand of his wife and the hands of his two daughters. For the compassion of the Lord was upon him. They brought him out. You know what they did? They grabbed them, grabbed the next one. They pulled them out of the city. They dragged them out of Sodom. And it is then they say, "Escape for your life. Do not look behind you. Do not stay anywhere in the valley. Escape to the mountains or you'll be swept away." Well, there's a negotiation that goes on. Lot says, "We can't get that far away. Please let us spare one little city that's not far from here." And that's part of the story, but not really important in this particular case. But then it says, verse 24, "The Lord rained on Sodom and Gomorrah brimstone and fire. He overthrew those cities and all the valley and all the inhabitants of the cities and what grew on the ground." And then verse 26 is our text. "But his wife from behind him looked back and she became a pillar of salt." Remember Lot's wife. Why? First, remember her for her disobedience. I mean, they were clearly told, "Do not look behind you. Do not look behind you." Now, that appears to be a small, insignificant sin, but there is nothing small about what she did. We tend to think that it went something like this. They're all fleeing, and all of a sudden the fire and brimstone's raining down on Sodom, and maybe there's loud booms, and there's flashes of lightning, and they're running away, and she just heard that loud boom, and like we all would do, just look back, like, what was that? Startled, a reflex action, and God said, I gotcha! Ah, I gotcha! Killed her right there. Yeah, that'll teach you to use your reflexes. It's not the story, folks. When you put it in the context, don't look back. Escape. Don't even try to stay in the cities nearby. Why would you say that? You're talking to a guy who likes this place. You're talking to a man who's likely to pitch his tent right outside there again and live. The don't look back isn't about just the glance. It's about more than that. This is not an insignificant, reflexive sin. It's not. Her actions seem more than a reflex. In Matthew chapter 6, verse 21, he says, where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. We've had all kinds of indications. Where is Lot's family's treasure? It's in Sodom. This is what they long for. It's in those three words. But he hesitated. Why? This is what we want. This is what we like. When God says, don't look back, he's using similar terminology to that which is given to you and me in Colossians chapter 3, verse 2. Colossians 3 verse 2 says, set your mind on the things above, not on the things that are on earth. Quit living for the things that are here. Don't look back. Don't express regret that you've had to lose those things. Man, I had it good when I was a non-Christian. Now that I'm a Christian, I can't do this, I can't do that, I can't do this. I don't have Sundays to myself anymore. All this. If you're thinking in that way, you're thinking like Lot's wife. And God won't allow his people to think that way. Remember her for her defiance of God. She is defying God by this. Her action is seen sometimes as just a little resistant, but it is not. It is a major rebellion against God. Look, just put it in this context. If I said to you, are you going to listen to me here this morning? Are you going to listen to me? And you said, for whatever reason, yeah, we'll listen to you. I said, seriously, are you going to listen to me? Because if you don't, it has consequences. Yeah, we're going to listen to you. Okay, I'm telling you, don't turn around. If you then turn it around, what are you saying about our relationship? You're saying, I'm not going to do what I told you I would do. I'm not going to listen to what you had to say. The angel's very clear. There's not a lot of directions. And don't take the road to the left. Take the fork that goes to the right. And don't go, don't stop at this. And don't do that. And don't take food with you. It's not a lot of instructions. I can't even remember all that he said. It's two simple things. Don't stop and don't look back. And I got to tell you, you have much more reason to not do what I tell you to do than to not do what an angel tells you to do. Especially angels, it can strike people blind. He has given clear indication of what he does not want. And they still ignore it. They're fleeing, they're hesitating, and his wife demonstrates that last act of rebellion against him, against her God. In Luke chapter 16 and verse 10, it says, he who is faithful in very little thing is faithful in much. But he who is unrighteous in a very little thing is unrighteous also in much. Sometimes God tests us with little things. I'm telling you, sometimes God says, will you do the little thing? Because if you won't do the little thing, you won't do the big thing. Because it's not about our assessment of what the thing is. It's about our assessment of who God is. And if he's God, whatever he tells us is important. Everything he tells us is important. So this is no small thing. Remember her for her defiance of God, and then remember her for her disbelief, her disobedience, her defiance, and her disbelief. She must not have thought her backward look would cost her her life. And what does that say? She didn't believe what God said. She simply didn't believe it. She didn't think that looking back would kill her. And this is her sin. It is not, there was a big boom, she turned around and God got her. It is the culmination of the hearts of this family. And she manifests it. I find it interesting that it says that she, from behind him, looked back. I'm thinking maybe if Lot had been behind her. See, and that makes me think it's not a reflex action. That if he had been behind her and she started thinking, I just want, and she got this far, he would have said, don't! Keep going. Turn around. Keep going. It's not a reflex. It's a longing. It's a one more look at the place that was ours. And God doesn't allow that. This sin of her eye. God had been so gracious to her. Think about it. Sent two angels to her house. They warned her family repeatedly that this is going to happen the night before and the day of. They urged them to move quickly to escape. They granted the concession of a safer haven close by. God said, yeah, you need to go closer by. That's okay. I hear people all the time say things like, if only God would, or if only God had, then this wouldn't have happened. If only God would do this, then I would believe him. If only God would grant this, then I would accept him. And I'm telling you, I don't think it's a matter of those little concessions at all. Look, put these words in Lot's wife. Put these words in her mouth and compare them to what we would do today. If only God would give me the advantages of a strong, righteous family. Then I would follow him and I would be faithful to him. She has that. I mean, I know that Lot is struggling with things, but Peter reminds me he is a righteous man. And you may say, well, how can you be a righteous man and have the problems you talked about today, Ralph? Well, how are you righteous and you have the problems you have? How am I righteous and I have the problems I have? I'm not perfect. But the tenor of our lives, I hope, is righteousness, is trying to do God's will. And she has that. Lot is spared in that situation. God brings him out of that. She has the advantage of a righteous family. And some people say sometimes, if only God would just speak plainly and strongly to me about what he wants. He did to her. I mean, he clearly spoke what he wanted to her, and it didn't make a difference. If he would only deliver a message I couldn't mistake. I hear people say that all the time. You know, if the Bible would just be plain about things. I hear people say that sometimes about the subject of instrumental music. I remember hearing Sewell Hall on a panel with some denominational preachers, and a couple of them on that panel were women in preaching in their respective churches, whatever they were. And they were talking, got to talking about instrumental music for some reason. And they said to Sewell, arguing with him, you know, if God didn't want instrumental music, why didn't he just say, I don't want it? And then we'd all accept it and agree with it. And Sewell said, would you really? Because he said he doesn't want women preaching over men. Didn't he? He did. He said that very clearly. And yet there are women on this panel who are saying, if God would just speak clearly, we'd listen to him. We play games with ourselves. And Lot's wife, if she said, I turned into a pillar of salt because he wasn't clear in his message. No, he was real clear in that message. If God could just convince us he's merciful and loves us and cares about us, hey, how much more care and love could you have than for them to be compassionate about you and trying to get you out of the city? And finally, if God would just show me his power, I mean, show me his power and I'll listen to him. Well, these are the angels who struck the men blind, and you didn't listen to that either. Hey, quick conclusion. 3 points. Remember Lot's wife when you're tempted to look at forbidden things. Turn away. Don't look. Remember Lot's wife when you long for the world you left behind. It's not worth it. And remember Lot's wife when you doubt that sin matters because it seems trivial to you. Remember Lot's wife. She tells us great things. And I don't apologize for the pillar of salt she became. She disobeyed. She was defiant. And she was full of disbelief about God. That's what caused her problems. And it causes us problems. Hey, do you need some prayers today? Maybe there's something special we can pray about for you. Do you need some help? We've sung some songs about turning our eyes upon Jesus. And that's where we need to focus ourselves. That's where we need to be in our lives. And we're singing another song about that same kind of concept, that we need to be looking to God every day. If we can help you with something, why don't you express it to us this morning so we can pray about it together? We're going to stand and sing this song. You do that.